This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Rambam says, "Al tomar she'en teshuvo elo me'averish yesh b'hem ma'aseh, doing znus v'gezel l'gnevo." Do not be of the opinion that tshuva only applies to transgressions that involve an action, such as immorality, theft. But rather, just as a man has to do tshuva from such deeds, so equally he must search out bad characteristics, bad character traits that he might have. The loshuv, and he must do tshuva, min hakas, from anger, min ha'evo, and from hatred, min hakino, and from jealousy, min ha'hitul, and from lightheadedness, mirdifas hamomin v'hakovid, and from the pursuit of materialism and honor, and the pursuit of food and other such things. Min hakol tzorich lasul b'tshuva, from all these things one has to do tshuva. Ve'elu ha'avoinos koshim me'eson sheyesh bohem ma'aseh. And these transgressions which don't entail a specific action, but are rather a general characteristic of the human being, are more severe than those that involve an action. Shebizman shodom nishka beilu, for when a person is immersed in these, koshehu lifrosh mehem, it is very difficult for him to stop them. When a person has done something wrong, he does tshuva and he doesn't do it again, finished. But when a person has a character trait from which he is trying to improve within himself, that can't be too easily achieved. The one character trait here that is of most interest to us this evening is the redifas hamomen, the pursuit of materialism. It says the Rambam is not talking about a person who in his pursuit of materialism does things which are incorrect, that he is dishonest in his dealings. We're not talking about that, because the Rambam has already classified that, gezel l'gneva, as those deeds which entail an action in the transgression. So that we're not talking about. If there's an action, if you're just a thief, that's easy to do tshuva. If you're a robber, it's easy to do tshuva. What's hard to do tshuva is simply, you wouldn't do anything wrong, you keep every paragraph of Shulchan Aruch, you know the whole Shulchan Aruch, you wouldn't take a penny that doesn't belong to you, you wouldn't be in the slightest deceitful or misleading in your business dealings. It's just that money is very important to you and you run hard and far for it. That's the Rambam is much harder, much more severe than theft, than robbery. The tshuva of a midah, improving a characteristic, is much harder than fixing a transgression. What is so terrible about redifas hamon? Person pursues money, good, he's a frum Jew, and he goes to a shir twice a day, and he's not dishonest, and he's not deceitful, he keeps Shabbos, he keeps kashrus, he's absolutely 100% frum in every way. Just one thing, redifas hamon, and that's all. That he's heavily involved in the pursuit of materialism. Why does the Rambam classify that as something so serious? I understand kas, anger. It's aggressive. If a person is a bal kas, he's a dangerous human being. He does things that he regrets doing afterwards. He says things that he regrets saying. He hurts people as a result of his anger. I can understand the Rambam saying it's a terrible thing, very severe. A person is involved in evil, in hatefulness, spitefulness. I can understand that's a terrible thing. But to differ some moment, a harmless fellow, all he does, and he doesn't do anything wrong, just that he is heavily involved in the pursuit of materialism. Why is that so severe? On another subject altogether, there's a very scathing medrash in this week's parsha on Dino, and more specifically on Leah. We're told that Dino went out. Liris bivnoisoret, she went out to visit with her friends. Not chas v'sholom with her boyfriend. She didn't have any boyfriends. She went out lilois bivnoi soritz, to go out and meet with the young girls of the land. What's a terrible thing? Nothing so terrible. Shechem sets eyes on her and rapes her. and the whole story which follows on that. Says the Medrash, Les isuso zanyo ad dibroso zanyo. You don't really know that a woman is unfaithful until you find that the daughter has been improper. Because a woman can be unfaithful, nobody will ever know about it. And if she falls pregnant, still nobody will know about it. Could be from her husband, or from one knows. But if one finds that the daughter falls pregnant, then you know that the mother was unfaithful. What's the one got to do with the other? Because where does she learn it from? A young girl learns how to behave from her mother. And therefore her moral standard is a reflection on her mother's. One can tell the mother's standard from the daughter's. The Medrash before that gave an example. We've got a shepherd looking after oxen. And he sees that every now and again there's a weak ox has been gored. But he can't find the nagkon. He can't find the ox that's responsible for the going. He can't watch them all the time. He's got thousands of oxen under these cowboys and the... In the Wild West there, he's got hundreds of thousands of oxen and bulls and cows, and he can't watch them all. So when his back is turned, one of them goes, he doesn't know who it is. But then one day he looks at the calves. Now the calves he takes care of, they're not that many calves and they need personal attention. And he finds one of the calves start going the other calves. And then he says, now I know who was the one that was going all the time. It's this calf's mother. That's where, otherwise where would this calf get it from? And through the actions of the child, the shepherd is able to understand and to perceive the nature of the parent. And that's what the apple finally fell from the buamaf, they say. And we see in Chazal that is so. That the child learns, the daughter learns tzniyus from the mother. If the daughter lacks it, the mother lacks it. Chazal said to him, says the... In Cain leo yemeina zoyna hoiso. That's a very severe statement to make. Are you implying then that Leo, there was something wrong with Leah's tznius? After all, Dina went out, and she's criticized for having gone out. Even though she only went out to visit with her girlfriend, still she's criticized. Are you implying that she got raped because Leah, her mother, Leah, our mother, that she wasn't 100% proper? Answer the Midrash, yes. Vatete Leah likrosuv. Leah went out to meet Yaakov. Remember the story that Yaakov was going to spend the evening with Rachel. And Leah has a word with her and gives her the flowers, and Rachel says, fine, well, you can spend the evening with Yaakov this evening. And Leah goes out to meet Yaakov. Says the Medrash, see? Vateitze Leo likroso, that same midah. Vateitze Dino. Dino went out. Leah went out. You see? Mother, the child learned from mother this business of going out. It's quite a problem in our society, by the way, that going out is so important. Staying home should be the highest value. That should be the real that's where the fulfillment should be, where the pleasure should be, where the growth should be, where the entertainment should be. Everything should be at home. And this need to go out is all part of a very sorry state of affairs, but that's another subject. Certainly in the home of Leah, in the home of Yaakov Avinu, in the home in which Dino grew up, there was no need to go out. It wasn't just the going out which Chazal criticized her about. Where did she go after all? Where did Leah go? She went to meet her husband. That's all. And she's being criticized for that. What was so terrible? Says the Medrash, Yotzos mekushetes kezoino. She went up with a lot of makeup on. Medrash says, kezoino, like a prostitute. Chas v'sholom, you can be quite sure that Leah, at her most made up, didn't look anything like a zoino. But for her standard, the Medrash feels it was a little bit overdone. For Leah, it was a bit too much. Lefichach, therefore, vateitze dino bas Leah. That's why the Torah tells us who went out. It doesn't say dino bas Yaakov. It doesn't say dino the daughter of Yaakov. It says dino the daughter of Leah. She went out to visit with the young girls of Shechem, with the young girls there, just as her mother Leah had gone out before. Although there's a big difference. Leah went out to meet her husband. Dino went out to meet the girls. Neither of them seems to have done such a terrible thing, for such enormous consequences to have resulted from something that appears to be really so insignificant. But more than insignificant, if we see the Medrash on Leah, the whole thing doesn't make sense. Firstly, as a result of that going out, Leah meets Yaakov, and they do spend the evening together. As a result of that spending the evening together, Who is born? Yisachar. Yisachar, who are the Lamdonim of Klal Yisrael, the Talmidei Chachomim of Klal Yisrael, was born from that association that evening. How can something so great result from a liaison which is negative? So you see, the liaison was not negative. There's no way that a Yisachar could have been born from a liaison which was on which the Medrash says Yotzo Mekushetes Kazoino. She went out Danat like a Zoino, like a prostitute. What does the Medrash mean? And from that comes a Yisachar. Medrash says Melamed Shelo Inicho Yisoy Lirchoitz Raglov. Ask the Medrash, why did she go out to meet him? Why did she go out? Titzei Leil across it. She's made the Yaakov is going to come home and he's going to have dinner with me and we're going to spend the evening together. That arrangement has been made already. So all she has to do is wait until Yaakov comes home, and she or Rachel will inform him that they've arranged between them that he's going to spend the evening with Leah this evening, if that's okay with him. That's the end of the story. Why does she have to vaktitze Leah likrosse? Why does she have to go out to meet him? Melamed says the Medrash Shelo Inicho Yisoy Lirchoitz Raglov. It is one of the wifely privileges. Now, I'm going to get myself into trouble here if this is not understood correctly, particularly on tapes. It is one of the wifely privileges, one which is not practiced anymore, because the men don't really deserve it. It is a wifely privilege that she washes her husband's legs when he comes home from work. Comes home tired, she gets a basin of warm water, she takes off his shoes, takes off his socks, puts his feet in the warm water, brings him a drink, and sits down and talks with him the events of the day. There are many things which in the halacha the woman is allowed to and in fact encouraged to hand over to a servant. And it is an obligation of a man to provide servants for his wife if they're able to afford it. It's one of the first things, as soon as they can afford more than their own immediate needs, before he buys the portion, before they put in the swimming pool, before they do anything else, one of the first obligations on the home is to provide servants for the wife. And many of the homely duties may be handed over to the servant. The servant may cook, the servant may bake, the servant may wash the dishes, the servant may care for the children. But there are certain things the servant may not do. And this is one of them. To receive the husband when he comes home from work and to make him feel like a king. That's a very special, intimate part of the husband-wife relationship. As I mentioned earlier, a part which is totally ignored today for many reasons. Firstly, because it's not fashionable. And secondly, because a woman can only do that if she really respects her husband. If her husband is taka like a king, then she will feel it a privilege to care for him when he comes home. But if he's just a nag and a nuisance, then all she wants to do when he comes home is disappear into the kitchen or go to bed or go out to a meeting, to a chesed meeting, or whatever it is, to make sure that she can, of course, by going out to a chesed meeting, she can escape all the obligations of chesed at home, and she can be busy with all sorts of things outside the home. That's if she doesn't respect him. But if she does really respect him, if she admires him, if she thinks he's just the most wonderful thing that there ever was, then that's what she would do. And that, as I say, doesn't exist today because our whole value system has changed. But that's how the Torah wants it. Now, Rachel, the Medrash tells, Leah, the Medrash tells us, didn't want to allow him to wash his own legs. So wait till he comes home, and then say, I've got the water ready for you, come. In modern day equivalent, it would be to run the bath for him. Imagine when he comes home, when she hears the car coming, she goes and runs the bath. When he walks into the house, he hears the bath water running already. That's what a wife has to do. But Leah doesn't do that. Leah goes out to meet him. Why? Because she realizes he's Yaakov Avinu. And Yaakov respects Leah no less than Leah respects Yaakov. And Yaakov isn't going to allow Leah to wash his feet. So he's going to stop outside the town and wash his feet there. So that when he can come in, he can say, I've already washed my feet. So as to not to subject her to any form of humiliation. But she's a step ahead of him. She goes out the town to catch him before he has a chance to stop at the bathhouses or anywhere on the way to have a wash. And she says, you come home, I've got your bath waiting at home. That's Leah. That's the Vatetze Leah Likrosse. That's why she went out to meet him. So that he shouldn't get in first to save her the humiliation, which to her isn't a humiliation at all, it's a privilege. So she goes out to get him before he has a chance to wash his own feet. And people wonder why there's no more romance in marriage. All one has to do is to live the Torah way, and the romance is maintained. You want to live the modern way, you want to live like the television say you better live, and the ladies' magazines, you can forget about the romance. You want to live like the Torah wants you to live, romance is there all the time. Look at this relationship. And this is with a wife that he didn't love so much. This is with Leah.
Amar Rabbi Avot, Sofu HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Ribbono Shel Olam saw Shelo Hoso Kavanoso Ela L'Shem Shemayim. The Ribbono Shel Olam perceived that her intention was 100% holy. L'Hamid Shvotim, she wanted to establish the Shvotim, and she felt that she was in the right state at that time to produce a Yisocha, but she needed Yaakov. L'Fichoch Hetzri Chakos of Lema V'Yishma Elokim Eleo, and that's why it says that Elokim Hashem listened to Leah. And from that comes Yisocher and also Zvulun. So we see how great that liaison was, says the Medrash. Now that's the same Medrash that says further on that Leah learnt this business of running out of the house. She learnt that from, that Dinah learnt this business of running out of the house. Mekushetes kezoino, overly made up. That she learnt that from her mother Leah. How can the Medrash talk like that? Just look at that episode. Look how beautiful was that episode. What sanctity was in that episode. And now the Medrash talks about Dino learning impropriety chas v'sholem from her mother. What does it mean? The Tiferes Tzion says the only thing that both Leo and Dino did wrong was that they went out with their makeup on. Leo shouldn't have gone out. You might remember that when Ruth goes to see Boaz, she takes her makeup with her and she puts it on when she's there. Because it's not nice for a young lady to go around in the streets well made up at night by herself. Where's she going? What's she doing? It's not the right thing. So she wants to look good for Boaz, fine. Leah wants to look good for Yaakov, no problem. The problem is getting there. You want to go out and meet him, that's also lovely. You want to wash his feet, fantastic. But the journey, the way out, to see Leah, this attractive young lady, dressed beautifully, with her makeup on, going out on her own in the evening. That's not 100% right. Why did she do it? We must say it stems from a certain naivete. She was totally naive. It didn't strike her that anything could happen as a result of it. And in Leah's case, nothing did happen. And Dina too, she's going out to see the daughters of the land. She's learned from her mother to dress well, that a girl should look good. She understands that. The mother has taught her that. And off she goes. And it doesn't enter her mind that Hashem could see her. And she thinks to herself, so what if Hashem sees me? Is that the kind of life he wants? Would Hashem want to marry me? Would Hashem want to become a son-in-law of Yaakov Avinu? Would he want to sit and learn in Kirtle for the rest of his life? Would he want me as a Rebbetzin? Is that what he would want? I'm not the kind of girl that Hashem would want. So she's totally naive and doesn't realize the danger at all. What danger is it that she doesn't realize? She doesn't realize that koyach, that power in which Esav excelled, is so all-consuming that it destroys all rationality completely. Remember from the shiur 2 weeks ago that Esav's whole speciality was in the area of presentation, appearances, superficial sensations, creating illusions, salesmanship, manipulation. That was his area of expertise. Yaakov was in MS. Yaakov was in truth. And that with the world the way it is, one needs both. As we discussed 2 weeks ago, one can't work only with MS. If you work only with MS, then when a man comes home after a hard day's work, his wife may, if he's very fortunate, wash his feet, and then he'll say, "No, good time for supper," and she'll say, "Yes, I've got a lovely supper waiting for you," and he'll come to the table and there'll be a mound of mush and 6 tablets, and he'll say, "What's all this?" And she'll say, "Well, the mush is some bran and some a little bit of carbohydrate, and the tablets are all the vitamin and protein that you need. I've calculated exactly what your needs are. You won't put on weight from such a meal. It's absolutely perfectly balanced. Health food, they call it. It's absolutely perfect."
smells it. It's takes one spoonful and he says, let's go out for supper maybe. And no, she's tired. And, so he leaves supper. Next time he has supper on the way home. What's happened? That's MS. She's prepared a meal which has everything which a man needs. It just doesn't look good and it doesn't taste good. That is the Esav side of us. We need presentation. Things need to be made to look appealing. Things need to be made to look attractive. Things need time, they need taste, they need reyach, they need smell. We're human beings. And we need to use our senses to do the things that we do. I have a theory, it's not borne out at all, but it's interesting that with all this health food kick that's going on, they're right. The health food is very healthy. But good taste is also very healthy. And I'm not sure what kind of side effects are going to result from people eating food which they don't like, just because it's supposed to be good. I'm not sure to what extent enjoying one's meal doesn't take a part in properly digesting it, in properly utilizing the various things. It's all very well that the food contains, it's back again putting all the emphasis on the object. In this plate of food is everything you need. The only thing that isn't there is a good relationship between me and the plate of food. That's what isn't there. And I'm not sure whether one can nourish oneself sufficiently from food which has all the objective criteria and none of the subjective criteria. Just as if you're a shadchan, you can't, you take a man and you say, I've got just the right chiddush for you. And you say, yeah, it sounds good, tell me about her. Oh, she's wonderful. She's wealthy. She's wealthy, fine, I need money, that sounds good. She's clever. She's clever, good, fine, that's wonderful. Is she attractive? Yes, she's attractive too. Good, wonderful. Go through all the miles. She's got yichus as well. And you say, no, he says, what's the disadvantage? No, there's no disadvantage. She's in her 70s, going on 80. She says, but I'm 22. Okay, it doesn't matter. Well, all the criteria are there. Whatever you need is there. So she's a bit older than you. So what? You can't always work with the objective criteria. There has to be something which claps. There's got to be dynamics. And so it is with everything that one does. There has to be a dynamics. One has to enjoy what one's doing. One has to have a feel for what one's doing. One has to have time. There must be taste in what one's doing. There must be pleasure in what one's doing. We'll come on to it further on that even in one's Yiddishkeit, there has to be pleasure. There has to be enjoyment. There has to be a positive relationship between the activities in which one is involved and between oneself. And so, Leo dresses properly. And Dino dresses properly. That's very important. Reb Elia was asked once what he thought about the Hungarian custom of married women shaving off their hair. And he said he was most opposed to it. Because the Rocheho Darchei Noam, the ways of the Torah are ways of pleasantness. A woman's meant to look nice. And to make a woman look ugly is anti-Torah. It's not part of the Torah. That's why also at the time, when sheitelach started coming out, there was a big tumult. Some said, a sheitel, what's the good of a sheitel? The women look better with sheitelach than they look with their own hair. And Rebellia liked it. Rebellia preferred the sheitelach. The women should look good. There's a din that her hair must be covered, but it must be covered in a way that leaves her looking attractive. The purpose of covering her hair is not to make her look unattractive. That there has to be in human relationships, there has to be an attractiveness. And so there's nothing wrong in Leo and in Dino looking good. They're looking good for good reasons, but they don't realize what effect that could have on an outsider. Why? Because they're too naive. Dino, that doesn't strike Dino that a Shechem could fall for her. A young girl from Beis Yaakov, literally from Beis Yaakov, from the that kind of family with that kind of value system, what's a Shechem going to want with her? The fact is it doesn't work, and Shechem falls for her. But Shechem falls for her in a way which is totally unnatural. She must have been very, very beautiful, because Yaakov was worried about Esav falling in love with her, and Esav had a taste for attractive women, so she must have been very beautiful. Nevertheless, Shechem falls for it in a way which is unbelievable. The brothers tell Shechem, you know, you'll have to convert. Whole family will have to have a bris. Good. Not only your whole family, the whole town, everybody's going to have a bris. Why didn't he stop at that point and ask why? Why must the whole town have a bris? What's she going to do with the whole town? I'm going to become a son-in-law of Yaakov Avinu, understand? I've got to have a bris. My family, maybe not, I don't know. But the whole town, every male must have a bris. Why? And had he used his seichel just to the slightest little bit, he would have realized that this is a ploy. There's something funny here. This just doesn't make sense. What's going on? Shem was not a foolish man. Shem was a successful businessman. What's happened to his seichel? Where is that seichel? The seichel is entirely gone. It doesn't operate. Rabsim Chazisul points out, that's the effect of the taiva. That is the effect of a craving. A craving is so powerful that it dismisses all other normal considerations and all other value systems. That at the time of the craving, nothing else makes sense whatever. That's why if a person has a craving for a cigarette, he can know intellectually how bad it is, how negative it is, what it does to his health, that it can cause his death. He can know all of that. It just doesn't help at all. Because when a person has a craving, there is no rationale, there is no reasoning, there is nothing which takes place in his mind which could lead him in any other direction. It is all consuming, absolutely and totally all consuming. And this we get from Shechem already. This Dina couldn't appreciate. That there could be a man who, just because she looks attractive and she's got a bit of makeup on, that he would be willing to undergo such hardship to get her. That is something that is beyond her comprehension totally. And therefore she never foresaw the negative effects of going out in public dressed over attractively. She did not understand the kerach, the power of the force of Esav. We have another case of it which Rav Simcha Zissel also points out, and that's the case of Esav himself. Esav, despite all the disparaging things we tend to say about him, was a very exceptional man. So exceptional that when Yaakov came back from living with Lavan, he was afraid that despite God's promise to him, he would not be able to succeed in a battle with Esav. Because Esav has such schus, has such merit as a result of his kibud avim and his living in Eretz Israel all the years that Yaakov was up. Now if we, for example, were living in Eretz Israel, it wouldn't make that much of a difference because we don't know how to live in Eretz Israel. We're not on the Madrega where living in Eretz Israel is going to make such an enormous impact on our level of schus. Yeah, it's a mitzvah, fine, like any other mitzvah. But for Esav, he was on such a level, despite his rishus, that Yaakov feared that his living in Eretz Israel was so potent, had such kedusha, such sanctity to it, that it would give him power to overcome Yaakov. That Esav's involvement with kibud avim, that his dedication to the honor of his parents was so enormous, that would give him the ability to overpower Yaakov, and Yaakov, despite the promises, would not be able to withstand the battle with Esav. That was what Yaakov feared. So Esav is no ordinary person. And what does Esav say? What does the Sorish of Esav say afterwards when he names Yaakov? He says, your name will no longer be Yaakov, it will be Yisrael. Ki soriso im Elokim v'im odom v'atuchol. For you have battled with man and with angels, and you have succeeded. Who's the angel? Esav. But this is a powerful spiritual force, this Esav. A man of great intellect, great wisdom, enormous talent, deep spirituality. Full of tumor. Very negative. But with all that power. And he sets out to destroy his brother Yaakov. He's been waiting for this for ages. Because Yaakov did him out of everything he wanted. Everything he wanted was the power to be supreme and to destroy the Jewish people at a later stage. So that was it. And Yaakov cooked him of that. And he's decided, come the day, he will destroy Yaakov. And finally he hears that Yaakov is coming home. Yaakov, some sons, daughters, daughter-in-laws, small mishpocha, coming. Yaakov, Esav gets together 400 army generals, each commanding a division. And he comes and he figures, there's no chance that Yaakov has against this. With all the Siyatat Ishmael, with anything he wants, 400 divisions under my leadership, each division under a general, there's no chance whatever, says Esav, that Yaakov can escape at this time. And he goes, you can imagine, after these years, after these decades of building this passionate hatred for Yaakov, finally the day has come, he's going to meet Yaakov in battle. Yaakov sends him a few animals, a bit of a gift, and his heart melts. And he's big mates with the Esavol, with the Akavol. Big friends, my brother and this, and they kiss each other and come and live with me, and they will go separate ways, fine, but let's stay in touch. Big friends, in a matter of minutes. What did it? A gift. We discussed a couple of weeks ago the power of the business lunch, at which Esav excelled so much. He tzayid b'fiv. He knew how to hunt people using food. He even knew how to hunt his father using food. He had the ability to seduce people, men and women, into believing in him totally and having complete confidence in him. And Esav is tripped up by his own mechanism. Yaakov takes him out to lunch, but what a lunch. Yaakov lavishes the most fantastic gifts upon him, and all the enmity is forgotten. That's an Esav. But such a man, with such intelligence, with such spirituality, with such depth, with an impassioned hatred, how does he lose all that so quickly because of a little monetary gift? Says Reb Simcha Zissel, Chemdas Hamomim, when there's a love for money, there is no space for anything else. Nothing else is important. Just as when Shechem loved Dinah and he wanted her, nothing else was important. So when Esav loves money, nothing else is important. Everything else loses value. The acquisition of material property is all that is really important to him. The Reish Chochma says in the beginning of the fourth chapter of Avas Hashem, of Shaira Avo, that we have to learn from this passage of Shechem how to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. We have to learn from this the power of passion. That's what it's really for. It's interesting that all this comes initially from the chait of Adam HaRishon. The first man ate. From what did he eat? From Eitz Hadas Toivera, which is a difficult phrase to control, the tree of knowledge, to translate, the tree of knowledge. Or the tree of knowledge of good and evil. What does it mean, the tree of knowledge of good and evil? And why did God forbid man to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Surely there should have been no better tree to eat from? To know what's good and what's evil? The Sikurna has an interesting translation of that term. He says the tree of knowledge, it doesn't mean the tree of knowledge. Eitz Hadas means the tree of attractiveness. And he talks about the fact that when Odom and Chavo became intimate with one another, the term used is Odom Yodo is Chavo Ishto. He knew her. He became close to her. So the Eitz Hadas is the tree of intimacy, the tree of attractiveness, of Toiv Vera, of something which is good and bad. What's good and bad? Something which tastes good, but it's unhealthy. Something which creates a pleasant sensation, but is morally or ethically negative. Until that time, there was no desire to do something which was negative. And until that time, Taka, I suppose that Odom would have been satisfied with a heap of mush if it had the right nutritive constituents. But after eating from the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra, man became attracted to things that were pleasant, although they were bad. Things that were attractive, although they were evil. That was the source of that whole element in the world, which Esav took to an extreme, and Yaakov took the Yemes, took the truth to the other extreme. And we're meant to learn that there's something to gain from that too. The Eitz Hadas, there was knowledge to be gained if we would understand that the use of that passion, that's what's meant to exist in the Torah as well. There's a passage in Mishlei, in chapter Kaf Gimel, in chapter 23. Havio lemusol libecho, bring your heart into Musar, says Mishlei. Don't just learn it intellectually. Don't just learn it superficially. Bring your heart into it. The Vilna Gaon says, Ki chol dovo she'odom mis'ave, anything which a person craves for, umagamas napsho elov, and his entire dedication is towards that thing, oysodovo miskayim, that thing lasts with him, that thing has permanence. Mashenkin in lo yiyasu libo leze, avshi yaseno lo yiskayim. But if he doesn't apply to his heart to it, even if he does it, it doesn't last. There has got to be an emotion, there has got to be a passion in our Avodas Hashem as well. That same passion which brought Shechem to suffer and to subject his people to enormous pain and ultimately to destruction for the sake of his one ambition because he was in love, that power which brought Esau to forget everything else in his pursuit to forget his hatred and his other ambitions and everything else in his pursuit of money, that is the power which has to be employed, that passion, that love, that dedication in Avodas Hashem as well. That we should develop a taste for it. That we should develop a geschmack, an enjoyment of it. That we should develop a love for it and a feeling of dedication towards it. Not that it's something which is done in a routine, but that it's something which is done out of Ava, something which is done out of love. And we need to know that there is no such thing as loving two things. Loving two things already is a compromise in love which virtually eliminates the concept of love. At the end of the day, love has to be all-consuming. And we see how in Esau's case, his love of money blotted out every other emotion and every other rationale. We see in Shechem's case how his love for a woman blotted out every other emotion and every other rationale. So we need to know that it's not possible to say, well, this person loves money and he loves Torah. There isn't such a thing. When it comes to love, there has to be a choice. One can enjoy many things, one can find pleasure in many things, but to love more than one thing, one can't. At the end of the day, one's that all-consuming emotion of Ahava, of love, can be dedicated in one direction only. And that is either it's Ahavas Hashem, or it's the love of other things, which are all-consuming. It's there that we begin to understand a little bit of what the Rambam means. That doing something wrong, one has to do tshuva. That's relatively easy. One has to do the tshuva, and one gets rid of the bad action. But when it comes to a midah, when it comes to deus rois, to bad characteristics, such as redifas hamomim, that's a very serious thing. And we ask, what's so serious about redifas hamomim? He keeps the Shulchan Aruch, he doesn't steal, he's not dishonest, he keeps Shabbos, he keeps kashrus, he keeps everything, he learns Torah. It's just that his main occupation is business, he loves money, he pursues money. Says the Rambam, there's no such thing. If a person is a roideif mamon, if he's an esav, that everything in his life revolves around his material acquisitions, then there is no space for anything else at all. It's true here and there he'll do other things, but there's no emotion in it, there's no real feeling in it. The feeling is all dedicated to that which he loves, and you can only love one value over and above everything else, because love means that for which you're prepared to sacrifice everything else. That's what love means. And if one's going to love, there's no such thing as then you love two things. Well, what are you going to do if they come into conflict with one another? You have to sacrifice one of them. How can you love them both? You've got to sacrifice one of them. Ultimately, one has to say, love is that for which I'm prepared to sacrifice anything and everything. And for that, there can only be an Ahavas Hashem. It's interesting, the point that Stanley brought out this morning, that the time at which the confrontation between Yaakov and Esau takes place is when Yaakov goes back to fetch his pachin ketanim. He goes back to fetch a few odds and ends to take over back over the forgotten one. He's involved at that moment in business, because if he doesn't go back, so what? He's got his whole family over the river. It's dark, it's not a good time to be on your own. His family's over the river, all his major possessions are over the river. All of a sudden he remembers that he's got some pachin ketanim, some little containers there. So what if he leaves them behind? It's a loss of money. So for the sake of money, he goes back. Now there are two possibilities. He goes back for the sake of money, because money is very important to him. Why is money important to him? Because he's prepared to sacrifice anything for money. That's one possibility. The other possibility that he goes back is because he realizes that there's no more where that came from. Which is a very important, I think we discussed that last year on this very Sedra, that when a person believes that money is generated by his own effort, a couple of pachim ketanim is not worth going back for. There's plenty more with that. Oh, I'll work again, I'll make up the money, it'll come back. That's not a problem. If a person believes that mizonosov shalodom tzuvim lo mirash Hashanah ad Yom Kippur, a person believes that the Ribbono Shel Olam lays down your maximum earnings from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, and that's it, then those pachim ketanim cannot be replaced. Whatever effort you're going to put in now is going to go to new things that was part of your possessions, and you no longer have it. So it is a midah of bitochin, of trusting in Hashem, to treat one's property with enormous respect, to realize that one dare not waste one's time and one dare not waste one's money, because money is time. Not time is money. Money is time. And one doesn't have the time to go redoing things over and over again that have already been done once. One doesn't very often have the opportunity to do that. So Yaakov either goes back, L'shem Shemayim, and says to himself, it would be irresponsible of me to neglect property which Hashem has entrusted to me. Or he goes back thinking, well, it's my money, and what will I do without my money, and money, money, money. The Chumash tells us that he battles with the Saru Shel Esav, with the angel of Esav, the Lo Yuchalo, and he was unable to get the better of him. Esav was not able to get the better of Yaakov. Why, says the Sipurlo? Because of Dveikusoi Bokel Yisporach, because of his constant cleaving to the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Dibur of a Machshava, both in speech and in thought. That means at the very time, the very moment of Yaakov's involvement in business, his mind, his ambitions, and his talk is all dedicated to Torah. There's no question at all that he's involved intellectually in business, that he's involved emotionally in business, that he's involved spiritually in business. That's not there at all. You can see from the way he's thinking, and you can see from the way he's talking, that even during the moments that he's involved in business, he's not involved in business, he's involved in Torah at all times. And as long as he's involved in Torah, the Sarah Shel Esav is not able to get the better of him. That's a time when he realizes, both Esav realizes and Yaakov realizes, that the business is not a redifa samone. If I went back to fetch the little container because I loved money, and I was all consumed with this love, as Esav is, then Esav is better at it than I am. Esav is a better businessman than the Jew. Esav is a better pursuer of money than the Jew. Esav is a better hunter than the Jew. And if we're going to try and meet Esav on his own ground, he's going to destroy us ultimately. We don't stand a chance. But if we keep to our own territory, and even when we're involved in our businesses and in our professions, our minds, our emotions, our thoughts, our ambitions are all directed towards Torah. We're involved in business in order to generate the income, to be able to learn Torah, to be able to educate our children in Torah, to be able to grow and develop in the way that Ribbono Shel wants us to, and that's why we're involved, and that is sincerely the basis of our involvement, then Esav doesn't stand a chance. And then Yaakov finds himself able to get the better of him. We're going to see Shiurim this week. Next month to Shabbos, we hope to have a bit of a Hanukkah party here. We will have a Hanukkah party here, to which everybody... If a person during the year finds that he's unable to learn very much Torah because he's pressurized, has a demanding job, one thing and another, all that might be very valid, and he's an onus, there's nothing we can do about it. Comes the holiday period, and that's the big test. The holiday period is not the test of how he spends his holiday. The holiday period is the test of how he would spend his entire year if he didn't have pressures. That's what the holiday tells us. The achievement, that which one is able to achieve during a vacation period, is not merely, or that which one is unable to achieve during a vacation period, is not merely an expression of what one does with one's leisure time. That's an expression of what is really important to one. That's what it really is. Now that the pressure's off, good, fine, no answers, no solution. Now what do I do with my time? Now how much do I grow? And there we're able to look at ourselves frankly. A holiday time is like a Yom Kippur time. It's a frightful time. It's very scary. Because you look at yourself and you see yourself for what you really are when the pressures are down. And you're able to say, this is all a lot of nonsense. I only learn 3 or 4 hours a day because I'm pressurized. And on holiday, when I'm not pressurized, how much do I learn? Also 3 or 4 hours a day, so it's got nothing to do with pressure. Nothing at all. Let's not fool ourselves. I don't have a chance to do chesed during the year because I've got all sorts of things on my head and I'm pressurized. Comes a holiday, how much chesed did I do? Same kind of thing. Relationships between husbands and wives, well, you know, it's the pressure of the year and all sorts of pressures. Come the holidays, no pressures. Now, how do you relate now? Much better? If yes, then good. If not, then forget the terutzin. Forget all the answers and all the excuses, because that's all they are. They don't mean a thing. The holiday time is a time that one really tests. What is it that we're testing? Is the holiday a period of gathering strength for a new year of effort? Or is the holiday an end in itself? Do I say,
Come a holiday, what do I say to myself? Ah, been a hard year. Now I can relax. My whole year has only been for the holiday. Or do I say, good, the year is over, that's the end of it, now let me take a break so that I can get going in the beginning of the new year. Different attitude. Where is my machshava? The actions are the same, but where's the machshava, where's the dibur? Is the thought and the speech directed in Torah and in Avodas Hashem that everything one does during a holiday is preparation for a year to come, or is one's thoughts and one's speech dedicated to how warm the seawater was and how good the surf was and who one met on the holiday? Where is one's involvement when the pressures are? Because the just as the level of one's week is determined to a very great extent by the level of the Shabbos before, and just as the level of one's day is determined to a very great extent by the level of the night before, if one spends a constructive evening, Gemara says, the Rambam brings it lahalacha, if one learns Torah at night time, then chut shel chesed nimshach olav, then there's a continuous thread of chesed which somehow enwraps the person the whole of the next day. It's a very fine feeling, and there's a very fine aura about a person who's had a constructive night. If our nights are merely seen as releases from the daytime rather than preparation for the next day, then the next day is negative as well. That's why for us the day starts with the night time. The day starts already with the evening time. So it is also with vacations. A holiday is either that for which one has been working all year, in which case it's a bit of a tragic situation that a person should spend 11 and sometimes 11 and a half months for 2 weeks, or not. The holiday is just a preparation for a year to come. There's no question that we do live under a lot of pressure, and I don't think the people in this country quite appreciate the extent of the pressure under which they're living. In every country there are pressures, and the pressures differ from person to person and from place to place. Sometimes the pressures are financial, sometimes the pressures are social. It's difficult to live like that. Each place has its own pressures, but Johannesburg particularly is a very pressurized society for many reasons, and the correct usage of leisure time is a key to the ability to achieve. And South Africa is still a place which allows a relatively large amount of leisure time. That might be changing, but at the moment it's still a place where there's a relatively large amount of leisure time. In highly competitive societies, there isn't leisure time. Shabbos is already a big sacrifice. Sunday is a normal working day already in many parts of the world. Holidays, you can take a few days, but if you're going to take more than that, you'll come back and find somebody else has taken your job. That's all. I'm very sorry, somebody better came up. That's all. There's no embarrassment about that. And you just can't afford, or you find that you're out of touch. The things have been happening, things are moving at such a pace that you've taken yourself off on a holiday and you come back, and you're just out of touch. You don't know what's going on anymore. Things haven't waited. Here somehow there is leisure time. The pressures are there, but the one pressure which is not there is that there's a relatively large amount of leisure time. But as South Africans, we don't fully know and understand how to utilize that leisure time. It's something we take so for granted, and we have so much of it, and we're used to having so much of it, that we're not really familiar with how to use it. A Sunday every week. Gosh, there are so many countries in the world where people would say, a Sunday every week? Unbelievable. You can sit and learn, that means you can go to shul at 7 in the morning and you can sit and learn there till 6, 7 o'clock. One day a week you can be in yeshiva one day a week, apart from Shabbos. Unbelievable. And yet how many people would you find in South Africa that do such a thing? Evenings, you can finish work at 6 o'clock. Unbelievable. You get home at 6 o'clock, you've got a whole evening to yourself. Incredible. Unbelievable. What can be done with those evenings? And how do us South Africans utilize those evenings? What do we really do with them? Shabbos can be kept without much of a worry nowadays. There's not such a pressure. It can be kept quite easily. What one does with a Shabbos. A holiday period that one can take a vacation. One can take time off. What does one do with it? All that is very critical. And while the formal pressures of learning stop in the Beis HaMedrash now for several weeks, it's a time that where great growth should continue. One learns what one feels like learning. There's not a pressure to learn a specific thing. Catch up on a bit of revision of the things one wanted to revise during the year.
to read Sforim, to learn Sforim perhaps, which one wouldn't get around to doing otherwise, to learn with Chavrusas, who one doesn't have the time to learn with during the year, all sorts of opportunities to enrich one's living in the learning sense, and in every other sense too, to be, spend time with the family in a positive and constructive way, spend time with friends in a positive and constructive way. That is allowed and enabled to be done in a leisure period. With the result, hopefully, that after that period we all come back feeling strong, feeling energetic, feeling revived, having used our leisure time, having used the vacation period, however much of it we've been able to take for ourselves, for the purpose of regaining strength, to dedicate ourselves, in Yirtz Hashem, in the years to come, to greater growth and greater development in Torah and Avodas Hashem.